You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
For the first time in a long time, I'm actually quite nervous about the Monetary Policy Committee of the Reserve Bank, because I cannot see how the Reserve Bank avoids raising interest rates by 50 basis points. Despite a struggling economy, despite money coming out of your pocket on a regular basis, you can have even less to spend. I wonder how you're feeling about it, if it's make or break time for your household, because you are feeling huge constraints as a result of your ability to spend. Or are you having a bit of a celebration because you're seeing your cash deposits growing in value, and you believe that that is offsetting the huge inflation that we're seeing in our economy? You can call us on 011-883-0702, tweet us at Bruce Business, or WhatsApp 072-702-1702. It was a terrible day across markets today, despite some good news on local inflation. U.S. markets trading between 0.75% and 1% down. This U.S. brinkmanship as to whether or not they'll be allowed to keep printing money to keep spending, of course. And of course it's going to happen. But the standoff between Republicans and Democrats is part of their political process, but it wreaks havoc with confidence for investors. Other markets around the world hit even harder. Stock indices tumbling 2% in London, Frankfurt, and also in Paris. Hong Kong had a horrible day. Inflation in the UK, worse than expected. It's raising worries that the Bank of England there is going to have to keep raising interest rates in a really tough economy there. In Germany, business confidence falling in what is the biggest economy in Europe. And in China, still worried. Markets are still worried whether or not this post-COVID recovery that we've been depending on is going to manifest in any substantial way. Isam Tlanga is the head of markets research at RMB. Our inflation rate coming below 7% for the first time in absolutely ages, I think probably in the last 11 months or so, Isa. Good news, but on the surface only, really, because unfortunately the truth lies a little bit in murkier under the covers on this particular one. Give us your view on the inflation numbers today.
Absolutely, Bruce. Headline inflation is lower. At least it's lower than expectations. But we had thought it would come at 6.8% because we saw food price inflation peaking. But I think the concerning aspect is that core inflation, which is a broad measure of underlying inflation in the economy, continues to trickle up. It went to 5.3% from 5.2% in the previous month. And that's what would concern the SARB. So while they will welcome headline inflation, they will welcome the moderation in food price inflation, which has been a concern for quite some time, they will be concerned about the uptick in core inflation, which is a much more broader measure. But I think it might give a reprieve from a 50 basis point increase to a potential 25 basis point increase. Bear in mind, monetary policy works with strong legs. But also, if we look at the economy, there are many seasonal factors that we have to take into account in a post-COVID world, such that economic performance is subject to significant revisions. So what do we see on a growth front? It's a very weak economy. Yes, the SARB has 0.1, the IMF has 0.1. Almost everybody, agrees that the economy is stagnant. But I think there's a hesitancy to actually say the economy is actually potentially going to contract, which will become a big concern for the SARB as well, because there is a particular level of interest rates that become negative for growth that ultimately become negative for the currency. So in an effort to protect the currency, if the SARB hikes too much, then it may actually achieve the opposite result. In our
it becomes self-defeating, Isa. So today's inflation numbers, although core inflation is picking up, the general trend of inflation in most parts of the world is down, and certainly in South Africa is down. We're still at a much higher level than is comfortable for us. We like inflation at or about 4%, 4.5%, thereabouts. We're still sitting at 6.8%. It's at an historic high, but do you believe enough has been done in terms of keeping interest rates elevated for the amount of time we have and will continue to do into the immediate future for inflation to sort of begin to soar down into that target range that is this mystical target range we depend on so much?
Look, we believe enough has been done. If anything, it is to it will be too much reactionary to hike aggressively from where we are. If you look at the SARB's own forecasts, it does indicate that inflation is going to moderate, moving back into target, in the fourth quarter of this year into next year. So there is no reason to continue to hike interest rates aggressively if you see your inflation going back into target. But also, what would be of a concern, I would guess, is that inflation expectations have de-anchored, and that is influenced by the weak rand that you mentioned, but also wage settlements. They have been coming in at higher than the inflation target band. That would concern the SARB. But we are now seeing sectors of the economy that are responding to interest rate increases. The sale of furniture, vehicles is now experiencing significant pressure. And that is going disinflationary in addition to the collapse of all the supply side constraints we've seen. They have more than normalized, which means we are no longer seeing the supply side constraints becoming inflationary. So why would we want to do too much?
I'm really hoping that the governor and his colleagues are listening very carefully to this, Isa, because I can't help but be concerned that we're going to see a 50 basis point increase tomorrow, just simply as a final blow to try and mitigate the worst effects of inflation. But as you say, it becomes self-defeating and destructive to the economy if we are not careful. And already this is an economy on its knees, courtesy of failures at Eskom, failures in so many parts of government, which are, really letting us down.
Absolutely, Bruce. I think from a monetary policy perspective, the SARB has to consider two things. One, do they want low growth with high inflation? That argues for an aggressive hiking cycle. And if you look in the global environment, if you look at the Fed in particular, they would rather crush the economy so they bring inflation down than having weak economic growth and high inflation. Central banks don't want that. But also from a growth perspective, you have done enough already, but the lags that come with interest rate increase and the impact on the economy are quite long. There is a risk of doing too much, especially in an environment where global growth is weak, your own growth is weak. But if you just also overlay the currency into the stages of load shedding, it's a perfect fit, which means load shedding is having a significant impact on inflation, and that's not going to stop. So you will be concerned from that perspective. So the SARB is caught between a rock and a hard place.
You guys at RMB were the first to call a recession for 2023. You're sticking to your guns on that one?
Look, we do. For all intents and purposes, if you're forecasting economic growth of 0%, which is where a lot of other forecasters are clustered, the SARB is 0.1. The difference between 0.1 and negative 0.1, for instance, is very marginal, especially for the economy that has changed structurally because of COVID disruptions. It's quite difficult to measure the performance of the economy to decimal points. The point on growth is it's stagnant. The risks of a recession, very high. So we're sticking with that.
Thank you this evening to Isa Mhlanga, the head of markets research at RMB. Today's inflation number, better than it was the month before, 6.8% versus 7.1%. No big surprises there. It's all in line with the expectations. But it is a positive signal, perhaps a positive enough signal, argues Isa Mhlanga, to keep rates steady at 25 basis points, the expected 25 basis points increase, rather than the 50 basis points, which has been widely speculated. And it's certainly felt like we've been pushing in that direction, courtesy of a sharply weaker rand in recent months.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Well, markets had a topsy-turvy day, and there was so much movement. My data feed was a complete mishmash. So let's get Chris Stewart at 91 to give us the final data. I think my data source melted down late afternoon. One said it was telling me we're 3% down, but others are telling me we closed down 1.5%. Where did we in fact close, Chris?
Yeah, good evening, Bruce. Yep, 1.5. That is the number for the day. Not a particularly inspiring day at all today. And not a lot of good news by the look of it elsewhere in the world. If you look at what happened to European markets and you look at what's happening to the US right now, unless things change around dramatically, with some very dovish FOMC meeting minutes from the United States, indicating unambiguously that they're going to pivot and that we've seen the top of the rate cycle in the US, which I think they're highly unlikely to do. We're probably in for more of the same by the look of it.
Yeah, huge volatility, and it's very unsettling for investors because, particularly today, it was our major international companies, the so-called Rand head shares, the shares upon which the JSE is built, that make up the lion's share of the volume of trade on the JSE. The most value traded goes on in these companies, whether it be Richemont, whether it be Naspers and Prosus, our big resources counters, and they're feeling the cold winds that have been hitting global markets for the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I guess the commodity stocks are starting to feel some concerns over commodity prices, the sustainability thereof, and I guess the likelihood of slowing conditions globally into the second half of the year. And as you point out, even some of the luxury stocks, which have been really bulletproof so far this year, starting to slow down and say, listen, you know, nobody's immune to this. We've still got Richemont up almost 40% year to date, but it has had a couple of weak trading sessions over the last couple of days.
Yeah, and that's because the world just looks at the standoff in the United States between the Republicans and the Democrats and debt ceilings, and we know it'll be sorted out. We just don't know when and to what extent it's going to be sorted out. And so, therefore, that uncertainty breeds uncertainty. UK inflation remaining stubbornly high. Germany's consumer confidence is low. China's not coming to the party. The world's feeling a bit sort of flat at the moment.
Yeah, it's exactly that. As you point out, another disappointing inflation print out of the UK. At least I guess they've got inflation into the single digits, but not coming off as sharply as anticipated. So that's probably sealing further Bank of England rate hikes still to come. We had the monetary authorities in New Zealand this morning indicating after a 25 basis point hike there that that's the last of it and they're done. The currency there didn't take particularly well to that, selling off more than 2% against the dollar on the back of that news. So yeah, there's lots and lots of volatility around. There's I think continued concerns around the sustainability of global growth. I don't want to call the US debt ceiling a sideshow because it certainly wouldn't be a sideshow if they didn't come to the party and make an agreement. But I still think there's all sorts of political posturing and game playing going on there. We've seen this before. I can't remember the last time we were stressing about the debt ceiling. It felt exactly the same. And at the last minute, everything was resolved. I think it was some, I stand corrected, but I think it was sometime around the time of the global financial crisis that we were last worrying about the debt ceiling in the US. But none of this is helpful. And, you know, growth numbers are soft-ish, not terrible, but soft-ish. And it's in that sort of soft-ish space where, well, you know, inflation is persistent. They're going to have to carry on going with rates. Data's slowing, but it's not slowing fast enough to unambiguously put the lid on inflation. So we're in that environment of slowly deteriorating global growth, but still ever tightening global monetary conditions. And that's not doing well for risk assets, right?
Market's been anticipating a 50 basis point increase tomorrow in interest rates. Isam Tlanga suggesting tonight that the inflation number, while still pretty awful at 6.8%, is in line with expectations. It shows that the bitter medicine of higher interest rates is working. Therefore, no need to raise by 50. Perhaps we can do 25 tomorrow. Would you concur?
Yeah, I mean, the inflation number was actually, I think, a little bit better than expected. I read something that said it was the most significant downside beat on the inflation numbers since mid-2019. And it does look as though we may have seen the peak for food price inflation, with food price inflation, albeit still elevated in double digits, moving into lower inflationary territory than it was in the previous month. But, you know, we do have a fair amount of, I guess, own goal inbuilt inflation coming through. We've seen it across the board in terms of industrial companies in South Africa that have been reporting results. I would concur that we could do 25, wait and see what the Fed's got to say, and wait and see the extent to which inflation slows. However, I don't think we're going to. I think we've got a pretty hawkish central bank in South Africa. I suspect quite strongly that consensus is probably right for tomorrow. We're going to see 50. I've even seen numbers of 75 bandied around, God forbid. I don't think we're going to see that. But I think 50 is probably a more likely scenario than 25. And I think we've probably got 50 coming in with no intimation from the monetary authorities that that's going to be the top data dependent. We might even have another one later.
One big corporate announcement today, and that's results out of Nampak. Nampak, of course, Andre De Reiter left Nampak, went to Eskom, and that's ended in tears. There was another guy at Nampak that didn't go particularly well. There's a very focused new management team at Nampak. Things seem to be turning around. At least the market was very pleased with Nampak's results on what was otherwise a negative day.
Yeah, I mean, I must point out, with no disrespect to Nampak, I mean, there was a time in the early 2000s when Nampak reporting results would very much have been a big corporate event. I must just point out that the Nampak share price, where it is right now, the market capitalization is less than 500 million rand, which means, you know, while it's interesting, it's still somewhat of a sideshow, I think, from an institutional investment management point of view. It simply doesn't have the market capitalization or the liquidity to be able to make a difference in portfolios today. And I think that's a sad reflection of what's happened to Nampak. If you look at, as you know, where it was as not necessarily a giant, but as a major player in industrial South Africa back in the early 2000s. You know, we had the Nampaks, we had the PPCs, a whole lot of construction companies, the Murray and Robertses of this world. You know, they made a big difference in portfolios, and we're not there anymore. We're now, as you point out, very much at the behest of the large diversified mining companies, the Naspers, the Processes, a couple of other global industrial companies that happen to be listed in South Africa. And then I guess, you know, some SA Inc. Players that are hanging in there. The banks have still got a reasonable market capitalization and reasonable trade representation. Some of the retailers are liquid enough to make a difference. But, you know, how the market has changed and the nature of the South African market has changed over the last 20 years, Bruce.
Chris Stewart at 91. Thank you very much indeed. Chris Stewart is a regular contributor on a Wednesday.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
A couple of my least favorite phrases in the world. Please hold. Your call is important to us. Please hold. We are experiencing unusually high volume of calls. You are number 97 in the queue. There are many, many others. Now, I don't for a moment believe the data that has come through in the survey, Ernest North, the co-founder of Naked Insurance. I think you guys have been hoodwinked, or you haven't challenged the integrity of the data nearly enough. But tell me what it says anyway, where you claim that the average South African spends 15 hours a month talking to call centres. And I'm sorry, that is just not feasible, likely, or anywhere near that any level that makes sense. I accept that we spend too much time dealing with call centres, and our experience is irrational and unsatisfactory. But surely that's not a data point that you can stand by.
Good evening, Bruce. It's nice to be chatting to you. I think you're right that. Different people certainly give different answers, and the data probably will show that different people experience something even worse than that, but some people probably something not as extreme as that. The bottom line is consistently in the research that was done, not surprisingly, people expressed some frustration in general about the fact that It's 2023, yet there are so many things we can't do online yet. And for so many things, unfortunately, we are still kept on hold while we have to speak to a call center to get basic admin done.
Yeah, but let's not pretend that it's 15 hours a month. I mean, it feels like 15 hours a month. And I've, you know, had people telling me about the experiences sitting with SARS for an hour at a time and getting cut off, and other call centers as well, highly unsatisfactory. Let's move beyond the survey that you did, which was done on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. That tells you all you need to know about the social media platforms. Please don't do surveys there again because they're not real. The fact is that customer service is slipping, and slipping really, really badly, because companies are pushing us further and further away from them by putting these huge barriers to effective communication called call centers between us and them.
I think the reality is that what emphasizes the sort of distrust or the discomfort that consumers have is that in some aspects of their life, it literally is just the click of a button. And then you come and in quite stark contrast, when you approach certain industries or certain services, it literally takes hours to get something done. And I think the reality is that it is difficult for many businesses to establish the level of digital transformation that is necessary to allow customers to do things online. And I think in this day and age, as consumers, we're surprised by the fact that we can't do everything with just the click of a button. I mean, there's light in the end of the tunnel. Lots of industries are showing significant progress in this regard. But I think as consumers as a whole, I think the main point we're trying to make, and sort of also with a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek reference with some of our advertising, is that it does not feel like this belongs in 2023.
So Mike tells me on WhatsApp, Avis Call Center, absolutely great in my experience. Very bright people and quick to answer. Obviously, some are better than others. But what call centers does your research tell you are particularly awful? I think the bank ones are very good. They tend to employ graduates. They tend to employ people who have a problem-solving mindset. And if there is a commercial transaction to be had, I think the call centers are pretty good. When it comes to sort of customer complaints and delivering customer service and the sort of sales channels of many of these call centers, that's where a lot of frustration creeps in. John sends a WhatsApp and says, the one is, to whom am I speaking? It's the one that gets up his nose. To whom am I speaking? And, you know, it's this, you know, I've answered the phone, I've introduced myself, and then we get there. Hello, could I speak to Mr. Bruce Whitefield is my favorite. My goodness. And then by then, my blood is at 300 degrees Celsius.
I think you're rightfully referring to a problem that's probably even bigger, which is the unsolicited phone call.
The recorded phone call, which Satan's representatives on Earth send. Yes.
The introduction of Poppy has not slowed down the unsolicited phone call. But I think what we're focused on is where you as a consumer, an existing consumer, are getting in touch with the service provider. Like you said, we were surprised that the feedback was that banks generally were good at keeping those phone calls short. Mobile phone and Wi-Fi service providers did not reflect positively. And then unfortunately, insurance companies and medical aids, people reported quite long delays relative to other industries. And I think the reality is that once you're a client with many of those industries, to subsequently get something done, to change a policy or to cancel something or to make a change, is unfortunately with many of the old school providers still a laborious long phone call.
The advantage here is that it's something that you can stand out in a sea of muck and destruction of joy and hope, to be different and proactive and positive and useful surely is easy.
Yes, look, Bruce, I mean, we've spoken to you before, and you've sort of kept an eye on the journey of Naked Insurance. I mean, it's obviously an important premise on which the business was built or initiated 6 or 7 years ago, is the reality that this is what consumers want. And for almost every scenario, if it's a simple product, if it's a simple transaction, if you can enable the customer to help themselves online, there may be times when they want to speak to you, and obviously then you must have a real human available. But I think that sort of banner of being available is used too easily to justify a poor online experience. And I think...
Sorry, Ernest North, we must leave it there. Co-founder at Naked.
702.
Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
There's an old joke that the Pretoria get traffic jams are caused by civil servants. The ones arriving late get in the way of those that are leaving early, and that's what causes the problem. And that's our impression of the public sector and government employment, of course. But we forget that the public sector is also police and doctors and nurses and people who do critical work. Professor Michael Sachs, the Deputy Chair at the Finance and Fiscal Commission, has been very critical today in something I saw written today about the budget process, of which he was once part as a Treasury official. And it's about the credibility of National Treasury when it comes to defining a budget on not just budget day, but whether or not the budget can hold up to scrutiny for 2 or 3 days at least afterwards. And already in this year's budget, Michael, I think you make the point that by factoring in 0% increases for public servants, the budget was out of date within 2 or 3 days because trade unions immediately pushed back and said, we don't think so. And that's been held to be true.
Yes, Bruce. I think the point I'm trying to highlight, though, really, there is a point about fiscal institutions, and we need to think about how we, if we want to save the budget institutions, probably the most important thing we can do is reform the way we negotiate and agree on public sector salary agreements and how those relate to the budget. The situation we have right now is clearly not optimal. Because, as you pointed out, the budget that was tabled in February envisaged essentially a zero increase for public servants in an environment of a cost of living shock that we're all suffering through. And remember that public servants received 0% increases in 2020. In 2021, they had about 4%, but inflation was higher than that. In 2022, they had about a 3.1% increase in their salary, when inflation was 7%, and this year we're expecting inflation to be above 5%, but the agreement has been around 3%. So it's really hard to argue that the agreement that the state negotiated is out of kilter with other trends in the economy. It's far below inflation, and it's far below settlements that are agreed in the private sector. And yet we are also in a situation where it is a significant additional unbudgeted item that now, according to the Minister of Finance, will require huge trade-offs in the budget as the year proceeds.
Yeah, the thing is, it looks good on budget day and, you know, you get a big fat round of applause. But if the budget process lacks integrity, if it's making assumptions that are not realistic, the entire process of creating the budget loses credibility. And that undermines you in future years because people stop treating the budget you present with any level of integrity.
I want to point out, Bruce, again, that I think the fundamental problem here is policy incoherence across government.
Generally, yes. Good point.
The problem is not kind of a technical problem of how National Treasury puts together the budget. The Treasury, in a sense, has been pushed into a corner by year after year policy directions that kind of second-guess or undermine what is in the budget. Uncertainty about across a whole range of issues. And in an effort to achieve fiscal consolidation and to kind of lower the expenditure that we're facing, the Treasury has kind of started playing in terms of a game-theoretic approach to the budget, of kind of trying to table it as a negotiating kind of opening bid. So you open the negotiation with a 0% offer, hoping to avoid a 6 or 10% settlement, and you end up with what you want, which is 3%. But along the way, you have now, it was February, you tabled the 0%. In March, you're already saying there's something that's going to have to shift. So absolutely, last year, for the first time, or since COVID at least, we had several adjustments to the budget during the course of the single year. originally the budget framework was supposed to be a medium-term framework. What we're moving towards now is a situation where the budget tabled in February, we're not that certain that that is going to be the numbers we end up with at the end of the year, because the budget is going to have to be adjusted along all kinds of dimensions during the course of the year.
Professor Michael Sachs must leave it there. He's in the Center for Inequality Studies at WITS, former Treasury official.
The Money Show.
Business Unusual.
Business Unusual brought to you by Workforce Staffing. For a thriving workforce, partner with Workforce Staffing, one of South Africa's top employers for 2023. Rich Mulholland, the owner at Missing Link, is prone to a bitter blue. I'm trying to work out how best to present this idea that we want to talk about tonight, Rich. Three reasons why your company conference is, and you used a bad word, I'm going to use the word rubbish, and I hope that you can too.
I will very happily use the term rubbish. The point remains the same.
No, exactly. Broad overview quickly. You and I go to lots of conferences. Some are good, some are bad, some are indifferent. And I don't know if a bad conference is better or worse than an indifferent one, because at least you remember the bad ones. But what's your overall sense of the way in which these things are working?
Well, Bruce, I think people enjoy the wrong part of a conference, right? So they go to a conference and it's almost the thing they have to deal with, which is the sitting in the conference room, listening to all the presentations. And that's what they have to pay in order to go and have the parties and watch the amazing speakers that maybe they bring in and see the entertainment that comes in the evening functions. And I think this is a fundamental flaw, because you don't fix a bad steak by putting on a garnish, right? So those extra things like the drinks and the parties and the guest speakers, they're nice, but they're the garnish. The job of a conference should be, to move the organization through a compelling discussion, at least in my opinion.
Well, and beyond a compelling discussion, actually, the purpose of the conference isn't just to reflect and tell ourselves how wonderful we are, but to make ourselves better. And to improve outcomes and to give people perhaps a tool or a different way of thinking about particular problems, particular environments, maybe get an outcome from a conference. It's not just about sitting around having a lovely chat, as nice as that is.
100%. And I think you hit the nail on the head there, is that the outcome, when we speak to people, say about, they're throwing a conference and they're organizing one. When we ask them about the outcome, they say, oh, we just want to bring the team together, or we want to, tell them this information or do this thing. And that's not a victory condition. A victory condition is if at the end of bringing these 500 people together in the room for 3 days, we haven't achieved X, we have failed. What are we trying to do and what are we all working towards? This should be an endeavor in progress. It's an event that the business should be different at the other side of. And I think what happened is we've so accepted the idea that, they're going to be boring. The presentations are going to be boring. That's okay. We just have to deal with it. That we make everything else nice. And I think that is unacceptable. I think what we should be saying is, no, well, if we want to move the needle of the business, how can we make the important stuff important again? Like, what are we not going to accept?
So often I notice there is, and depending on the organization, of course, sometimes organizations, gutsy ones that are looking for change, are willing to be provocative. They're willing to challenge delegates. They're willing to push the boundaries. So often, though, there is a retreat to safety, to being inoffensive, to de-risk the conference of anything anybody may find just a little bit too challenging or upsetting.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. And what it is because we've accepted a level of mediocrity or even sub-mediocrity when it comes to the standard we hold people to in things like traditional presenting. The joke I always make, I think I've made it with you in the past, is if the acceptable level for swimming was the same as the acceptable level for, presenting, we would drown. It's one of the few places where we said, well, I know this thing is critical, but we'll just let people show up and be rubbish, which I don't think is good when we consider what's at stake. And just one of the little things where people are unwilling to rock the boat, to your point, is, we're so worried about not offending everybody that we give everybody the same time slot. So the marketing team can present for 20 minutes, then the HR team will present for 20 minutes, and then this team will present for 20 minutes. We are allocating time based on parity and not priority. to me, it should always be, hey, how much time do you need to make the point you have to make to the people in front of you? Not, here is a slot of time that you have to fill. So we're attacking the idea of the management of human attention so badly. And then we're paying them back for doing that by getting them pissed at the bar that night. And I just, it's amazing to me that smart adults are allowing this to carry on.
And the people who are going to the conference sort of leave the conference and go, well, that was rubbish. And I don't know what the feedback loops are like. Every conference I seem to have, you know, there's a rating card, there's a, you know, a tick box exercise that people go through. And I just wonder if you could do just one thing to raise the level of every single event that you go to, what would that one thing be?
I would absolutely change what is accepted. So I would simply no longer look. The bottom line is, if you're doing a speech for an hour and there are 300 people in the audience, that is 300 hours of human attention that are being spent.
Yeah,
that is a crime to waste it. I think we need to realize that wasting attention, and especially when we think about what is the outcome, if we manage to move the needle in the right direction, right? So if we manage to give the attention paid to us and spin it around, what would that mean? And I think what I would no longer accept as a leader, if we just change the bar of what we will accept when it comes to paying people back for the attention they pay us, I would simply turn around and say, guys, we're no longer going to accept. If we just didn't accept that you could show up and be mediocre and show up and deliver a subpar communication to the people standing in front of you, I think that everything would change. Even if we shortened the conference by half and did more entertaining things, but just said, look, if you're only speaking for 5 minutes, make it five great minutes. Make your point. Move the needle of the organization. If I had to change one mindset in the minds of somebody organizing a conference, it is not about the information you deliver, but about the change that you're planning on making. So it's not about at the end of the presentation, they will know this. It's at the end of the presentation, they will do this. And if I could only change one mindset of presenters at a conference, that would be it.
Yeah, getting people to do what you need them to do. Don't be scared to have fun. Don't be scared to actually have people walk out and go, that was fabulous. I've learned something. I'm acting. I'm going to change the way I do something. And I also really enjoyed that as an event, in addition to the party in the evening, the juggling and the fire eating and all of the other stuff that tends to go with the big ones.
Yes, 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 yes. 100 times yes. We want to bridge the gap between the entertainment and the information. So the one way of doing that is to make really boring entertainment. The better way of doing that is to make really enjoyable presentations. And, you know, both you and I are professional speakers, and we understand that we have to, part of our job is to inform the audience, but part of our job is to make sure they really enjoy themselves while we're doing it. You know, if I can pay a compliment to you, new podcast, I only listened to the first episode, and the
Which podcast is that, Rich?
The Genius Podcast by Bruce Whitfield is brilliant. It's really, really
in partnership
really
with Prime Media Broadcasting, the new episode of which is landing tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock, all about discovery and the origins of discovery. The one that talks about Investec in 91 and the first episode on Nando. Sorry, I'm taking over from you, but you mean that podcast series?
Yes, that podcast. But let's talk about this relative to what we're saying.
Sure.
You could have shown up and you could have done a straight one-to-one interview with Robbie, and you could have delivered the message. So you could have dotted the I's and crossed the T's, but you didn't. And I would really like people to listen to that first episode as a metaphor for, if he just asked the questions and we just laid it down, that's a presentation. Okay, so you've dotted the I's and crossed the T's. But now what I want you to look at is the level of thought and storytelling and narrative that went into it. And the exact same story is now it's still informative, but it's enjoyable. It was a really, really enjoyable thing for me to listen to. I laughed, you know, when we, the tail gunner bit, I still laughed. I know it's wrong, but these elements come across. Now, if you apply the same mindset to how you show up on a stage, which I know you do, but if anybody did that, then all of a sudden you understand what your role is. We're not asking you to take the information away when you want to bring the fun in. We're saying that these two things not only can work together, but should work together. And it's so learnable, right? It's so possible to do. But
Rich Mulholland,
well done.
Thank you. I mean, thank you for that, but also thank you for your contribution this evening on The Money Show. And yeah, I'm really enjoying building the Genius podcast series, and we're being as creative as we can without distracting from the messaging and the content and the important stuff, but trying to make it listenable and bringing in those fun elements, and Nando's happens to lend itself perfectly to that, and the really lovely stories in the Investec one. And also just Adrian Gore's list. He starts off Discovery with a list. And if you've got a bright idea and you really want to try and grow it, you could do a lot worse than 7 o'clock tomorrow morning, subscribing to the Genius podcast series, listening to Adrian Gore, and of course, to all of the others that have been published and yet to come.
The Money Show.
Consumer Ninja.
Wendy Nola, our Consumer Ninja. Insurers behaving badly. There's a common theme coming through this feature. Wendy Nola, what's the latest?
Okay, so when the insurers don't abide by the decision of the Ombudsman for Long-Term Insurance, they do run the risk, and a very big one at that, of being named and shamed when the Ombud issues what they call a final determination against them. And then they publish the case in all its revealing detail, and of course, they get named, which mostly doesn't happen in these case studies that these ombudsmen publish in the public interest. Okay, so yesterday, the Ombudsman for Long-Term Insurance, OLT for short, released its annual report for last year, along with the Ombudsman for Short-Term Insurance, OSTI. The two offices having merged in a sort of soft amalgamation in 2020. And taking up quite a lot of space in OLT's report are five final determinations that the office issued last year. So how it works is, if after considering the submissions by the complaint about their insurer, to do with a dispute, the Ombud, and of course by the insurer as well, counter argument, the Ombud issues a provisional ruling. If it's against the insurer, in other words, they take the side of the complainant, in some cases the insurers will record their disagreement, but they don't formally challenge it. They accept it begrudgingly. But sometimes when they feel very strongly that they are in the right and the ombudsman is in the wrong, they lodge a formal challenge, and then there's a whole process of a series of meetings which culminates in a final determination. And if that determination goes against the insurer, that whole story, including the name of the insurer, is published on OLT's website and in its annual report, as we saw yesterday. So the insurer is taking quite a big risk when they dig their heels in this way, because those reports are very revealing indeed. So I thought I would not enough time for all five, probably not enough for more than two, but I thought let me give an example of how those determinations dish the dirt. Okay. So Mr. K, the uncle of the complainant, had been in and out of hospital when he asked the complainant to take out a funeral policy on his life. So she bought what she thought was a funeral policy from Suntum. Her uncle died in January 2022, after which she lodged a claim. Suntum declined it on the basis that she hadn't bought a funeral policy at all, but an accidental stroke, natural death, and hospital cash benefits product. Suntum contended that Mr. K had been added to the policy as an additional dependent, but he was neither living with her nor financially dependent on her, which Suntum argued was non-disclosure on the complainant's part and entitled them to decline the claim. And Alti said other complaints received by our office concerning this product show that the complainant's assumption that it was a funeral policy was not unique. So they argued that when there's an unusual term or condition in a policy, such as this one, that the person had to be financially dependent on you and living with you, the insurer had a duty to draw attention to it. Ah, said Suntum, look here, this is, we put it here in this small print. The adjudicator said, it was too small to capture a consumer's attention. Their words, the adjudicator's meeting was of the view that even if contractually the insurer was entitled to decline the claim, the benefit should be paid on the basis of fairness. And so Suntum agreed to pay the claim and the benefit of 40,000 Rand. Okay.
Good.
And then another case. So that's like, and as these are things I deal with all industries all the time. So that's like sneakily too small print, right? And obviously there were other cases about this particular product that went to Alti. And then, now this one is about a misleading telesales call. And there were actually two in those five determinations. So this one was a policy was administered by a bank and underwritten by the Liberty Group, taken out in September 2019, providing cover for death due to so-called non-natural causes. The insured passed away just 8 months after the policy was taken out. Liberty declined the complainant's claim on the grounds that the insured's death was not due to non-natural causes. But the Alti adjudicators pointed out that asked during the telesales call, you know, when this policy was being taken out, what cover he preferred, he said life cover. When the call center agent mentioned non-natural, it was in a rushed manner, the adjudicator said, and often inaudible. And the insured was never asked if he understood the terms of the cover.
It
just make you want to puke.
No, but I love the fact. I mean, yes, as revolting as it is, I love the fact that these complaints go into the granular detail.
This much detail.
And that's so encouraging because that's got to keep the insurers sharp, surely.
The devil is in the detail. I've listened to many of these calls in my career, Bruce, and you can so clearly hear that the consumer is not actually getting what's on offer and what it's about. And it's clear, but the call center agent doesn't pick up on that either unintentionally or intentionally, we can't say. But anyway, this call, according to Liberty Group, passed its quality assurance process. Okay, so it must be fine. A subsequent adjudicators meeting noted with concern that even though the insured was Afrikaans-speaking, the call was conducted entirely in English. From the insured, he kept talking about his medical conditions, right? And this policy doesn't cover medical conditions, only so-called non-natural. They didn't pick up on that. They decided that an amount of 30,000 Rand should be paid to the complainant by the insurer, being Liberty, as compensation for poor service, on top of a refund of the premiums paid. But Liberty said that there had in fact been a meeting of the minds at sales stage, and that they argued that the insured was perfectly intellectually competent to understand everything. And so they refused. They said, okay, well, the bank offered to pay 15,000 compensation. But in the end, Alti issued its final determination and instructed them to pay, refund all the premiums and pay an amount of 30,000 in compensation. So they ended up paying 31,320 Rand as a result.
Amazing.
I wish we had time for more, but that's just a little taste of the kinds of detail and that comes out in these final determinations. The insurers are taking a big risk because here it's all laid bare. We can see exactly what went on and what naughtiness happened.
Yeah, it's fabulous, Wendy, and I take huge... I mean, yes, it's frustrating that things go wrong. Things will always go wrong, of course, but it's I take huge encouragement from the level of granular detail that the investigators go into when the complaints are aired, and you do get resolution. Wendy Nola, our consumer ninja.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
So Saturday at the Frontier Literary Festival, I was asked to talk to White Besson. I had him for an hour at the Ingia Kerk in Franschhoek. And it's a beautiful venue, beautiful wooden paneling everywhere, wonderful big cavernous space, a bit of an echo, but that's fine. And you will hear White Besson talking about part of the conversation we had with him on Saturday. I started off this part of the conversation by asking him about the decision by ShopRite to withdraw from 8 of its African markets. It has basically suggested that these markets are unprofitable. White Besson making the point that he sees it differently. The demographics of the African continent, 2 billion people by 2050, as many as 4 billion people on the African continent by 2100, necessitate thinking differently about how to serve those markets into the future. And so I asked him if his former colleagues had made a mistake.
If you look, I think I left in 2017, the diluted earnings per share at that stage was 8 rand 60 cents.
Right.
8 rand 16. It went down as far as 669, and it's currently at 818. So 860 was still, in 17 it was still bigger than today by whatever cents. But if you take the inflation growth just at 6.5% for 5 years, that works out that you should have been 37% better off.
Yeah.
That's missing. So they shouldn't use Africa as an excuse that is now where they lose money. It's not factually correct in terms of, and you can have that checked.
But particularly with the potential growth opportunity, and I mean, and it's a difficult growth opportunity as Walmart has discovered with the acquisition at your behest, because I think you were worried that they were going to come in and either buy Pick and Pay and give you a club there. But you suggested... Why did you buy Massmart instead? Did you know that it was going to distract them and keep them very busy?
I actually helped them.
Did you?
Yeah, the guy who came there for the what's name was in my office and he said, we'd like to buy ShopRite. I said, I'm not sure if it's up for sale, but ask Christoph because I knew he was going to tell them the same. And I said, I know it very well because Mark Lamberti and I are very good friends that ran Massmart. And I gave Lamberti, I actually helped him do the second biggest, because he didn't have space for all those big stores. Because I wanted him as a partner for Africa to do the non-foods in Africa when I could concentrate on the groceries and the los chiquis. And then I showed them, this is what you should go for. Look at this, Massmart. Lamberti's prepared it. Typical, he's a Walmart man, look at it. And they took it, hook, line, and sinker, and they bought it. So I was very happy that they bought Massmart. And then they messed it up with getting game on shelves. And really, and I don't want to say, Walmart is a fantastic company. I learned a lot from them, and I spent a lot of time. I used to spend 14 days a year in America with David. I don't know if you can recall David Watkins. He was this number two guy at Pick and Pay at some stage, and he went to live in America. And he helped me to take me to all the different companies in America that was on the up. And I took 3 or 4, 5, 10 sometimes of the guys with me. And the same as I did with the unions, and we went there and worked in the actual shops. They allowed us to actually go and work in the bakeries and whatever you have. So I was pretty clued up as to what they were doing. And Walmart was one of the companies who were streets ahead of everybody else. But there were other companies doing. Kroger's is now the number one, I think. I spent a lot of time with them as well. So how can I describe it? You have to manage it. And when Walmart bought, I thought they would come with real serious oaks that were traders. But by then, old man Sam Walton had already passed on. I actually missed him by 3 weeks. Yeah. I was going to see him in Bentonville. And I sat in a lift shaft for the whole night. Because there was what are these things that turn the red circles on the TVs? When the weather comes in and they sucks you out of the window.
Tornadoes, yes, hurricanes.
I was in a
context is important, right? We got this.
I was in a tornado coming down the streets, and we could see it coming through with a guy Darren Fine, who I think he weighed about 400. Kilos and he used up all the oxygen in the lift shaft. So that was my meeting with Sam Walton. I was in the lift shaft, didn't see him at all. And then the next morning, when it was gone, we stole bolognese and stuff from their fridges because they didn't offer us food that night. I was actually in their fridges cutting up bologna and bread. Anyway, I thought they would get those guys in, but they brought computer guys in. You know, they worked some out in the after hours. And I said, when I saw them trading, I thought, no, that would be wrong. And the second thing I did was I spoke to government and I said, you must keep them listed because that puts a barrier on their heads. Because nobody likes to go out there and your children at school says, oh, your share price dropped by 25% or 30% or whatever it was. So I knew they couldn't do business decisions, because if they could do that, they could do it out of their petty cash. They could destroy South African retail out of their petty cash. But I had them listed, and I see they're trying to shake in this listing, and I always say to the guys who are in the play now, just keep them, let them report back to, like the church, you report back to the congregation after a while.
What makes great retail?
Hard work is number one. Hours and hours of hard work. And then if you can get a combination of professional people who enjoy the humdrum of being a retailer, that is what you require to make a team work. So I had a hard time finding enough retailers, old school retailers, that could go to the next generation or to the 50, I think we were the 55th biggest company in the world. I couldn't find enough people to get there. So I took young chartered accountants, lawyers, etc., and said, you're going to get a good job, you're going to get a good salary, you're going to get shares, which was always a difficult one. So we had to go that way to train people to run the company after my time or through my time. And if you look at the management of ShopRite right now, they're fantastic guys. They really are. Peter Engelbrecht is a hard worker. He comes from a poor background. He's got a CA. He's very strong, competitive. Joe Bronze runs the liquor stores. And most of those guys that are there are really fantastic. My worry about ShopRite right now is that I've got this fantastic middle management, executive management, and I've got a board now who's very much like the Walmart board.
What does that mean?
That means that they don't know what I mean.
Oh, dear.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Boards in South Africa, non-executive boards, really are not related to their business. And you saw that in Steinhoff, you saw it
We'll get there.
Okay, well, then I'll leave it. I won't leave a bad note on whoever his name I was going to say. You asked me, but that's the problem. And that can be the downfall of ShopRite over a period of time.
It happens slowly, doesn't it? It goes slowly, slowly, and then suddenly. Yeah.
Slowly. But you can see the tea rooms will be bigger and the number of conferences will be bigger and the meetings take longer and nobody answers the telephone and you all leave at 4:45 and not 5. So that happens because that's the culture that it brings. And there's nothing wrong because it's just two sets of people that you have.
I look at the secret of retail, and it is what a man called Sam Cohen from OK had embroidered on a handkerchief, which I'm assuming he used to stick in his top pocket over here. And the letters are YCDBSOYA. Which is?
No, you'd read it out to the audience.
You can't do business sitting on your ass.
That's right.
You already, I think, were operating in that way, but that must have affirmed your approach in terms of, because you're very active. Family holidays you would destroy regularly by going into, if you were in Path and Norster and there was a ShopRite, you would go into the ShopRite and you would for 3 hours and the kids would sit in the car and wait. Because it is the drive that you had personally to walk the floor and to make sure that everything was right.
You can ask any... He said, I must look this way sometimes as well because it's bad.
The cheap seats,
it is bad manners if I don't. And this is a lovely lady, so I won't look at you after.
I don't blame you.
I think anybody that's been in retail understands the situation that when you are in retail, it involves a hell of a lot of humdrum work, long hours, and you actually get. Every day you lose a bit of your brain power, so you have to pump it up with reading, etc. So it is really a unique type of career. And I practice as an accountant as well. So I know that I've felt both sides of it. And I think it's just vital that it's there. I mean, if you speak to Raymond at his age now still goes to board meetings.
Yeah.
He goes to board meetings.
They must love that.
No, Gareth says it's fantastic, but he's on the right pages in any event. So it's there. But so what makes Ackerman different to the other guys in the trade? He's just a bloke that enjoys simple things, looks at that and says, listen, change that.
People used to think he was this really sweet little man who would go and push the trolley out to the car for the ladies. And he was gathering intelligence. By the time they got there, they didn't have any clothes on their backs anymore.
He was the smartest retailer. Rainier was the smartest retailer I bought.
Okay.
And I think Raymond was number two of retailers that I knew on a daily basis that I pushed arms with, etc. And I say this when the kids became, I think in the book I talk about first, now I did some other place, first generation, second and third generation. So Raymond was a wealthy guy. So that story that he started with 20 cents in his pocket is not factually correct. He didn't tell you what he had in his boot of his car.
Was he a member of the ANC?
No,
just checking.
But the Ackermans, there's a crowd called Ackerman Stores as well. So
yes.
Remember that.
AC Kermans, yes.
AC Kermans. So he's one of the guys who came from a wealthy family and really started doing basic things right to build up that company, which is built up on his own.
As people give you the credit for ShopRite. How important was Christo in the process?
No, Christo is not a retailer. So let's start off with that. He's got a very good retail brain, doesn't like being on the floor, doesn't like too many people around him, but as a corporate thinker, he's probably the cleverest guy I've worked with in that area of the world. So when we look into a deal, then he looks at all the graphs, et cetera, et cetera. We move that to that, then the price goes up. And not the price of rice, the price of the shares. So he was always driven as a corporate guy. The fact that they call him a big retailer is just a misnomer. He invested in retail stocks.
Yeah.
But in that, he is very, very good. But doesn't like detail, doesn't like working on that type of thing at all.
So he once said to me, he told a story of your son. And you said to your son, what do you want to be one day? And he said, I want to be like Oom Christo. And he said, why do you want to be like Oom Christo?
It's true.
He says, because you do all the work and he makes all the money.
That's right. That was my second son, yeah. He wants to be like him. Christo does no work and he makes all the money. You work your arse off and you don't make money.
But you did okay. I mean, there was a fair amount of... I was reading some stuff yesterday as well. One of the chief critics of your salary was the then chief executive of the Public Investment Corporation.
Brian Molefe.
A young man called Brian Molefe, yeah. He of the Eskom Pension Fund. Yeah.
I got Anne Crotty to write that I was underpaid. You saw that in the book.
Absolutely.
But Brian Molefe, and that's true, I sent him a message to say that I don't lecture full-time anymore. But I am open between 5 and 6 in the afternoons if he wants to know the difference between a salary and a bonus. I can teach that to him.
Did you get a response?
No. I didn't tell it to him. In those guys, you tell it to the bloke right at the back because you know he's sitting at the back because he's Brian Spell.
Yeah.
So
very good. What was it about Marcus Uister that you knew was rotten?
I really didn't know anything about Marcus Uister's dealings or wheelings or whatever. I disliked the fact that he was extravagant on himself. I could never work out if it was his company's money or his own money. And he had a way of... Christo can laugh at himself. He's a... ordinary bloke. Sometimes he's quite common. You know what I mean?
Is he?
Yeah.
Good to know.
He comes from Uppington.
Okay, no, good point.
He learned to speak English on the way in. But Nuestra is a bloke that I think he has an air about him. If he has a yacht on the Med, then his yacht is bigger than anybody else's yacht. And I could just never see that it worked, that he was a guy capable of running the empire that he was controlling. So I said to Christo, it's impossible. It can only be the Lord that can run a diversified business like that and make a success out of it. So that was my criticism of him. I never saw him doing anything wrong. I never saw him, and I'm still not convinced that they say he could have cooked the books and all sorts of things like that. I'm still not convinced on that one, because in a big company it's still very difficult. And if it's true, then they must give us a PwC report to read. So I cannot tell you that is something wrong, but I can say that things like going to the rugby and spending 80 million rands or whatever the numbers are, you would know better, on a rugby trip, and my mates go and they had nothing to do with Steinhoff, and they go on a trip, and I ask Christo who paid for it, and he says Marcus paid for it. The next week I ask him who paid, and he says no, the blokes paid themselves. And the only bloke that I know that paid for himself was G.D. Ferreira.
Yeah, well, he insisted on paying for himself, didn't he? He insisted on paying for himself.
He said, you can take this check if you don't want to give it to charity.
Yeah.
But that's the only one that I know. So it's
but an example of that, though, I mean, an executive who shall remain nameless was in his office the one day, and one of his colleagues came in late. He said, oh, why are you so late? He said, no, I've just come back from England. Oh, what? No, went shooting. Oh, that's nice. Who took you? I know, went with Marcus. I said, now we've got these Purdy shotguns, and we've got these...
Yeah.
And it was like hell of a trip. And this executive then just, oh, that's very interesting, thank you very much. And he went, phoned his broker and said, please sell all my Steinhoff shares. Because if that's how he treats shareholders' money, I don't want to be invested. Thank you very much. And it's a similar instinct.
I was not that close to him. In fact, I never... They say he had a girlfriend, and she looked quite good-looking when they showed... You know, these... photographs, you can open it wide and close it. You know what?
No.
I must show you how to do it.
See, okay, thank you.
I you want to look it. At her head, you can open just the
okay.
But I never knew if he had that girl. She was very good looking. So I would have liked to have met him on his beach days as well. But I don't have
but
any...
But operationally, you were looking at his operations, as you did when you were looking at acquisitions.
Useless.
You were looking at acquisitions, you saw... Bad operations.
Bad,
and you looked at his
bad.
Operations, you went, there's no way that the valuation that's attributed to this thing is because of what's going on in those stores all over the world.
I did work with Sanlam to say, what is the valuation? I gave it to Christo. I looked at his footwear business, gave it to Christo, took photographs. And I knew quite a bit because I worked with Rainier on it, and he taught me that on the ground floor. And just nobody took notice that the meetings were... I mean, if you look at the... It's like I said to Christo one day, he was the chairman of KWV or something. I said to him, you know what? The only thing bigger than KWV's profits. And he says, no. I said, you're bored. Well, yeah, we must be careful about KWV.
We don't. Housewives of the Vainland.
I was going to say to you...
Everybody knows.
I was going to say to you after this, I hope you give it a fame glass of that KW.
When Christo comes to you and he says, you know what we're going to do?
Yeah.
Marcus is going to buy ShopRite. And then you can report to Marcus. What was your immediate response? maybe edit for the church. I don't know. But
I nearly dawned him. I was so cross. But he didn't say it like that. Christo's never, ever done to me that you report to that one.
Yeah,
I said, I report to the board in general from any company. I don't report to anybody. Then I wouldn't work. So I must be honest that he never went and said, you must do it. But, I mean, the structures that were drawn meant that he would control Pepco, ShopRite, through the what's-his-name, and Christo would control the holding on top. And he says, but I'm here... Is it, and when you're dead, what must I do? Must I throw USD into the beach of the Clifton Flat? I mean, Yeah, he's still alive. I can't say things like that. I just read it in the papers. But who's the owner of the papers here? Anyway, I was cross because Christo couldn't understand what I told him about the operations. And in fact, I offered to take... I said to him, when they built this place in the Strand, Poco or something, I went there one day and I said, Christo, this is a design to make you bankrupt. You should go there. And I told him the whole thing. He never went there. 2 weeks later, he says, he spoke to Marcus about it. And Marcus says, I'm totally wrong. That thing is doing substantially better than the budget. So he went and shoot the bastard who drew up the budget and left. So I never saw anybody. And that's what I said to you about boards.
Mm.
You in ShopRite, I appointed the current...
We are going to have to cut it there. But it was a fabulous discussion. It was a really lovely discussion with Whitey Besson at the Franschhoek Literary Festival. If there's appetite, contact me and I'll see if anybody wants the whole conversation posted. We'll see what we can do. But it was a really good discussion. Whitey Besson, his book, Whitey, is available in stores.